Okay, so welcome everyone to Virtual Machines, finally resuming after the holidays. So today we're going to close up with the part for the logical machine and the functional machine for, well, with the chapter that is on the issue of heap being polluted by leftover heap objects. And this is usually the topic that garbage collection is all about. You might have already heard about something like that. So during the execution of Mama and Vim, there obviously is some point where you leave a lot of unused references to value objects and structures in the heap, and they are at some point no longer reachable through references from that particular point of execution on. So since these don't affect the outcome of the computation anymore, they are usually not meaningful at all anymore, and thus can be called just garbage. And instead of keeping them around, it would be highly desirable to free up the space that they have and just reuse that for creation of new objects. So so far you have already seen that the Vim already provides some kind of deallocation. But, well, this is something that only frees the storage of failed alternatives. So a more general way to look at that is this area of garbage collections. And, well, there are a lot of different approaches to garbage collection, hand-tailored to particular language features and virtual machine features and certain ideas of the environment in which they run, certain ideas of the programs that are run inside that particular machine. So there are a lot of special purpose garbage collection algorithms around, and this is a highly active field of research, and a lot goes into the area of parallelizing garbage collection, making garbage collection concurrent to the actual execution of the current program, and so on. So there's still a lot going on there, but well, one of the basic principles of how garbage collection can be done is a thing that we will see here. And yeah, this is done within the concept of the so-called stop and copy collector. So this is the one that we are going to see here. So this usually works by partitioning the main memory into two sectors, where one is assumed to be the garbage polluted area, the so-called from space, and second part of the memory that is conceptually there for a new version of the current heap that is freed from all the unused heap objects. And as the name already indicates, this is a copy collector, so this tries to extract everything that is still reachable from the program, and it extracts that from the from space and copies it into the to space. So this is so far completely free of everything. And as soon as the algorithm terminates and everything is transferred, or everything useful is transferred from the from space to the to space, you usually swap roles, and the former to space is the new from space, and the former from space is the new to space. So they flip their roles in that sense. So when do you actually usually perform collection of garbage objects. This is, well, this is once again one of these areas that is highly active, and it's, well, you can of course have these definite points like memory exhaustion, where you want to actually call the collector, where there might be clever other strategies like certain times when there's not a lot of activity in your system and a lot of threads are waiting, then you usually want to use the capacity that you have for computation to perform collection, for example. So there's a lot of heuristics going on in that field, but the criterion where you should definitely do collection is memory exhaustion. So then usually you start with collecting. And in our world, we talk about something like the stop and copy collector, in the sense that during the actual collection, we stop acting on the heap. And this is a thing that has caused a lot of, well, controversial discussions of the principle of garbage collections, particularly in applications where there's user interaction. And as soon as you start stopping all the main threads from acting on the memory, then you usually perceive that as kind of a stuttering effect in terms of responsiveness. So this is probably one of the main reasons why these virtual machine and garbage collected systems were perceived as being, well, not a desirable thing. However, there is a lot of research going into the field of trying to make the stop the world phases of these collectors as short as possible, and to try to reduce it to the bare minimum of what is actually necessary. And yeah, so usually in modern garbage collecting systems, you should not perceive these stuttering effects as intensely as it had been in the beginnings of these systems. Anyway, what we, for our purposes, we still have a very simple garbage collection, which just stops everything and starts analyzing the heap memory and does all the necessary stuff to clean up the memory before it then resumes ordinary execution. So what is usually done in stop and copy collection? Well, there's several phases going on there. First of all, you want to make sure that you keep everything that might be relevant for further use in your program. And the criterion for that is, well, you can't say for sure, but what you can say for sure is that everything that that is still usable needs to be somehow accessible through some reference that is stored somewhere, and the only things that can be still read from your current program's execution point is usually everything that is reachable through some reference from the stack, where you usually keep your local variables and all the so far open function frames. So that is a good place to start, and usually everything that is then transitively reachable from everything that you can reach from the stack is usually also considered to be reachable, and thus of possible importance for later for later execution. So what you usually do is you mark all the reachable objects in the from space as your first step. So this gives you indicators for all the objects in the heap, whether they are still possibly important. And for all the non-reachable objects, you know, well, there's no chance with my current machine state that I can still reach these objects. So it's safe to not preserve them, thus they will not be copied into the two space. So after marking, you usually then continue with doing the actual copying. So you run through all the reachable objects in the from space again and move them over to the to space. Well, at least that is what you would like to do. However, there's still the matter of possible references to the things that you have on the on the heap objects themselves. So what you do for those is that you usually put some placeholder objects on the heap that just redirect memory to the new locations, and then the next phase you then start on correcting the references that are still in the now residing in the two space heap objects. And if there are references that are still pointing to the from space, then in a sweep on this to space, you just look up the references and correct the references to their new versions in the to space. And if you're done with that, you can usually then exchange the from space and the to space, and well, let the program run for a while and then restart reclaiming your memory whenever it's necessary. So for the first phase, the mark thing is, well, that's the detection of all the objects that are still alive. Well, you follow up all the references in the stack, we said, to point to live objects. And, well, every reference that is within such a live object, again, points to another object that is then also considered to be alive. And this is somehow just an instance of what graph reachability is considered to be. So, as an example, let's start with a situation like this one. We could just consider all the, or follow all the references that there are. So the one that we start from in this example comes from here, which would be probably some reference on the stack. So this points to some heap object. So this is a thing that should probably survive garbage collection. So this is reachable from the stack itself. All the others are not. However, there are still references in this live object. Those two that points to this object and this object. So they are usually also considered to be alive. Then there's another reference in there that points to the structure there, but this has already been reached in our reachability thing. So, well, there's no additional information gained here. So you notice that there's only one object that is superfluous. This has not been reached with our reachability algorithm so far. So this is probably not reachable, at least with the root nodes that we are emanating from now. And for our purposes, this is the garbage object that we desire to remove at some point. So this is the mark phase of the garbage collection. So then next phase would be copying phase. So this moves all the live object from the from space to the to space by just plain copying. So first of all, there's a copying there. And then what is done is that there's
left behind forward references to the new places in the old from space. So, yeah. So this is the situation with the partitioning of memory. There's the from space and the to space. And then you step by step visit the thing. Now, I think the version that you see here is already somehow combining the mark and copy phases into one thing. So we don't emanate from a marked graph, but instead, as soon as we hit a live object, we immediately copy and leave behind a reference to the new live thing, and also we will probably rewrite the original pointer to this new thing. I think this is not covered on the slide yet. So, from this object in the two space, then we follow the other references, which will lead us to the objects C and D. So C is placed over there, and the reference is kept behind, and D is also reached with a back reference left behind. So that is all that the copy phase does so far. So everything that remains now is to traverse the two space and the stack in order to correct the references. So it says here stack. Depends on where you whether you have already done the adjustment to the original pointer or not, but in principle you also have to run through the stack to correct all the references that there are. So in our case here, we then just run through all the new objects in there. In case that the pointer is pointing not into the two space, we know this is a pointer back to the outdated memory area, and there we look up the new reference and patch the new address into the addresses there. So step by step, we thus remove, for example, here in the A thing, the so seems that goes like this here. It removes the A references, then next we remove the D reference, and then the C reference is also removed, and then it's just about patching the original heap, the original stack reference to point to a new thing, and then we can just exchange the two spaces so that we now have a compacted version of the old one. So this is kind of the general principle that is behind that. So usually, since a lot of the runs that you do through the structure are quite similar to each other, some implementations tend to optimize by doing a lot of these things in one go. So marking, copying, and placing forward references, for example, are often put into a single pass, although they're conceptually a little bit different, to reduce the number of passes that you have to do on the reference graph. And in terms of complexity, the runtime of the garbage collection, if you think a little bit about that, is, well, you have to run through all the live objects and the stack, so it's proportional to the stack size and the number of live objects that you are going to reach throughout that thing. So this in general is quite nice, however, considering that we want that to be applied also to our logical machine. This needs to somehow fit into the constraints that we have put on the heap memory in the logical machine, and particularly must harmonize with backtracking. For that to work, you, for example, need to rely on the relative position of heap objects being as it is. Well, it doesn't matter too much about the actual real offsets. Those are not really playing a role for the heap objects, but the ordering in which you find the objects in heap actually plays a role, because there are certain comparisons on addresses performed. That, and there's concepts of throwing away a lot of addresses if they are positioned somewhere in sequence to something else. So, yeah, for the logical machine, you usually want to keep the ordering of the memory objects intact. Also, the other thing that the logical machine has is that during backtracking, you somehow have to manage to reset certain bindings that you have done in a failing branch. And this is done with the trail part of the virtual machine, and this also keeps heap references, so this should usually also be updated to new positions. So in order for that to work, you will probably have to keep mark and copy faces separate, since copy needs to keep the ordering, and in order to do that, it needs to run through the memory in in memory order in that sense, and not in in the ordering that the graph structure gives us. So if you reconsider what has been done in the non-logical machine constrained garbage collection, you see that here the order in which the memory objects are found is that there's A, B, C, D in this ordering, and after transferring everything into the memory, we see that A, C, D is now in that ordering. So you usually want that not to happen for the logical machine, and instead what you want to do is do a mark phase first, and then do a linear run through the from space, and then keep the reachable objects in the ordering in which you find them there. So there you see that ACD is still in the same ordering as it had been before, like this, and that is the desired outcome that you want to have for the logical machine. Yeah. So this has, of course, a certain consequence on the runtime of the whole thing, since now we have to run through the from space directly and not following just the live objects. We are not depending complexity-wise on the number of live objects anymore, but instead the total amount of from space, and in case that you run the garbage collection only if you run out of space, this is just kind of one part of your memory that you get there. But yeah, you have to do that in order to keep the ordering intact. So much about the garbage collection. That is, well, the bare minimum of garbage collection that we plan for this particular virtual machine. There's a lot of more sophisticated versions around there, and if you pay attention to the patch notes for things like the Java Virtual Machine, for example, or .NET, or whatever you follow, then you already have an idea of
how much work goes in there. Almost every year or every second year, there's a new garbage collection concept integrated into the respective virtual machine, and well, they usually offer them also in the form of, well, being configurable for your virtual machine. So depending on the application that you run, you can configure your machine to use garbage collector X or garbage collector Y. So there's a lot of those concepts still being developed, and yeah, it's worthwhile to look into. But well, at least for the focus of this lecture, we will leave that area now and go on with the topic of object orientation and support of object-oriented features in the translation schemes that we have started already. So, classes and objects it is. And, well, if you look at this example here, you already see that this is at least somewhat similar to what you see in C++, for example. So you can imagine that same as C++ has at some point been developed out of what C has been, we will follow a similar approach here and start from the concepts that we have established for the SIEM machine and just add a few extensions so that we can support features that are object-oriented and somewhat resemble what we can find in C++, of course with a few restrictions. So this is the typical example of code that we will see during this section. So there is, of course, ordinary things like our global variables. Then we have new items like this class thingy, which opens a scope and carries, similar to structures, certain data items that we consider to be attributes. And we can have several of them, like this. And this class thing seems to work somewhat like structures did. So you always have an identifier along with the actual type of class or struct. Then there's things that you see over here that resemble a little bit of functions. However, this thing doesn't have a return type, and even more, what should give it away is that it carries the same name as the data structure containing that. This is a so-called constructor and is there for initializing data. It carries, or it receives a few parameters usually, and that's what you see here, and with that you can then parameterize the initialization, and this is the actual constructor code here. And well, the another component that you see here is a method, which is a function in the context of an object with a particular name and signature, as you're used to that, with some new, or for us here, new keyword virtual. And this has, apart from that, I think, no particular new things. Well, it refers to a few things that are defined over there, like these. So this is accesses to attributes. And yeah, that is more or less all there is. So this is the amount of syntax that you can expect there. So this is somewhat similar to C++.
At least it says here, well, there's a lot more to C++ than just things that we see here, but yeah, that is probably how certain people imagine C++ might be. Yeah. So for our purposes, we see this as just a plain extension of what C has been so far, and what we focus on in here is basic things like classes being extensions of structs. So it's just having data fields like before, now called attributes. There's constructors and member functions. For member functions, there's several possibilities. They might be virtual, so called dynamically depending on the actual identity of the underlying object, or they might also be dispatched statically. So if you leave away the keyword virtual, then usually everything reverts back to static method dispatching, and this is the way that it had been all along for us. And yeah, then there's static member functions also, it seems, that are like ordinary functions. So what we don't do here is focus on anything like accessibility or visibility in this. So public protected, private is something that we won't bother with in this particular part, since they are more likely to be covered in things like type systems anyway, so this is not so important for our purposes. Also, another thing is we won't tackle things like multiple inheritance, although multiple inheritance might be what actually makes a lot of the concepts that are used for this C++-like implementation a lot more useful. So if you're more interested into how things like these multiple inheritance things work, then you're welcome to join me in winter in the programming languages. So, all in all, let's talk about the features that we will cover here. The object layout here is a thing you might wonder how to represent. Well, in order to support things like virtual member functions, you are relying on the runtime system to somehow dispatch the method to the method that corresponds to the actual type of the underlying thing and not being statically dispatched. This only, well, this needs a runtime support in the sense that the runtime will have to look up what the most recent implementation for that particular method would be. So this is, there's several ways of achieving that. Well, the more or less simplest one would be to have kind of a chain of predecessor function lists and search through this chain of lists for the first occurrence of the signature that you're looking for. However, this is a thing that a lot of people associate with lots of times linear runs through lists of ancestors, and thus think that this is a bad thing. In modern systems, you can usually circumvent these things by hotspot compilation and just put, after a few times of doing this lookup, you can just put the actual address of the thing that you dispatch to right there, together with a runtime guard, and then don't do any lookups at all anymore. However, in languages that are not so aggressively hotspot optimized, you cache these lookups in the chains of ancestors through these so-called virtual function tables, or, well, this is what they are called in this lecture here. I think out there in the wild you usually see them as virtual tables. So these things are used to cache the lookups in the chains of ancestors for the most recent implementation of methods, and they usually contain a little bit of not only function pointers but also offsets and addresses and all that. However, since we only focus on a subsection of inheritance, like single inheritance here, we can probably just restrict ourselves to function pointers. Thus, it's virtual function table instead of virtual table. So, yeah. All in all, since they cache a run through the chain of ancestors, this run is usually depending on the of the element on which you actually start. So if you now use one of these virtual function tables to cache these runs, you will get one table for each class that you can instantiate in the program. So these virtual function tables are specific to these ones. They exist for all for all classes that you have in your program. Depending on what classes are actually really instantiated, you can then just select the ones that actually are instantiated and put them into your object file and carry them around as your as some constant lookup table in your memory, and be done with that. So, in order to connect them with the actual instances of classes that are called objects, what you usually do is you put reference into your current object representation that points to this virtual function table that is specific for that particular class. So all the objects of one class share a virtual function table that is there or exists only once in memory. Apart from this virtual function table, you might wonder about the statics or non-virtual member functions, and, well, those don't need any runtime support for looking up the most recent version, so they can be resolved at compile time and directly compiled into the actual call. Apart from the function dispatching, there's also the aspect of actual data in terms of attributes that are carried in objects, and there is the matter of classes extending each other. So you might wonder what that means in terms of a layout of object representation. Well, in order to reuse a lot of the code that is out there that addresses the attributes in offset to the start of the memory representation of the object, you usually leave the attributes that already exist at the offsets where they are, and if you extend a class with a new attribute, then the object representation just appends at the end of the object space new memory slots to carry the representation for these new attributes. So let's have an example for that. So this is the memory representation for the class that has been specified before. So you see that apart from a lot of verbose constructs, there's not so much actually created in memory. So this is the object representation of this list thing that has a representation for its attribute info and the attribute next that is just living next to each other, preceded by one special item, which is the reference to the virtual function table for all the list classed objects, and this points to a centralized list of all the virtual function addresses that is kept for all list for all list objects, and this has as its only entry so far the last method, since this is the only virtual method that is defined. So, what we have also already announced is that in case we have a subclass that extends an earlier class, the attributes or fields are appended to the corresponding fields of the superclass. And in case that we also specify new virtual functions, then those are also appended in the virtual function table, at least in terms of layout of the virtual function table. So for this example here, we extend that now with a new class MyList, which is extending the so far list with a little bit of more info like this. This means that in terms of data layout, we have exactly the same layout as before, just added with a new element, more info. Let's assume that we also specify a new method. Like this. What then happens is it says here that the same applies to virtual functions in the new virtual function table. What you should keep in mind is here, or what you should pay special attention to, is that it's actually a new VFT. So it's not that VFTs in that sense are recycled. If you have a new class, you usually also have a new virtual function table. So if that had been the old virtual function table for list, then there is actually a new virtual function table with two new entries, or with two entries, one being this last thing and one being the newly created method M. The reference now goes to this one over here, and the only thing that you can assume to be sure is that the layout that the virtual function table has in the, has the newly added extensions added at the end of the old layout. So if there is the borderline between the old and the new layout, then this part corresponds to what the old virtual function table had been, and the new part is added down there. So it's not the same VFT memory area that is just appended by one, but usually since you can have several subclasses of a particular class, you can't really recycle the old virtual function tables, so you need to create new ones, but carry over the layout that the old one had, so that you can always be sure that the first entry points to this method last. Okay, so for classes now, in order to translate things that relate to objects, classes, and all that is around that, we now have certain elements that are found at certain offsets to well-known things, like start of the object representation. What we have done for structs was that we carried around particular specific address environments for the structs, and so we also do for each class. So there's an address environment row C that corresponds to everything addressed within the representation of C. So this maps the identifiers that are visible inside objects of class C to relative addresses A. So with that now, we can have a look at what all the different things now are for which we can resolve identifiers. So this is what the table down there shows us. So there's the things that we already know quite well, which is the global variables, like these ones here, that are flagged with G and have an actual address there. Then there's the local variables flagged with L, addressed relative to the stack pointer. And then there's the new ones, like the attribute flagged with A and carrying some relative address A with it. There's virtual functions flagged with V, carrying another offset with them. There's non-virtual functions marked with N and carrying some address with them, and static functions also flagged as such together with their addresses. So you might have noticed that for the non-virtual functions, static functions, we had direct addresses A in there, but for the virtual functions we had offsets. So this fits to the things that we have prepared in the representation. Non-virtual functions and static functions were the ones that we could directly statically compile code for calling them without any other means. For the virtual functions, we had to perform runtime lookups to dispatch. So this is why we don't have direct addresses, but offsets B here. So these have to be looked up inside the virtual function table. So for the variables, we might wonder what we can find for the L values of them. So let's just do a case distinction of what this X might be. There's the newly introduced keyword this. So that is a thing that we also haven't had before. This can be considered as a thing for which we can do LHS code generation. Yeah, I'm a little bit unhappy with how it is here, because this somehow makes it look like this is syntactically considered to be an actual identifier, which usually it is not in compilers. Usually you have that as a particular keyword, So don't take this particular case distinction here for granted. You might have to work your way around that a little bit in practical systems. But conceptually, this keyword, this acts pretty similar to what a variable would be. But well, this is usually kept apart from what usual identifiers are. So this is interpreted as some load R minus 3. Well, looks odd, but well, maybe let's talk about that a little bit later on. Then there's our usual stuff like the global variables. So they just correspond to a load from, or well, its address comes from loading a constant. Then there's our local variables, which we can which we can interpret as just its address relative to the stack. And then there's the new exciting stuff, like the attributes over here. And again, for those, we have this mysterious load R minus 3. Then we add a constant offset here to the whole thing, and this gives us the actual address where the attribute lives. So twice now we had this mysterious load R minus 3, and this if you look up what this load R does, this loads relative to the stack pointer or to the I think the frame pointer it was, wasn't it? Now it's time to look up what the old SEMA thing actually really is. So with having two other virtual machines in between, it's quite difficult to think. But I think it's the frame pointer, isn't it? Yeah, so it's relative to the frame pointer. So this relative address minus 3 to the frame pointer, does that ring a bell? Do you still remember what the SEMA was all about? Don't we somehow address something weird that we have already reused for other purposes with loading minus 3 from the frame pointer? Not so sure about the layout of the SEMA, are we? Well, anyway, the frame pointer minus 3 in SEMA terms usually addresses into the area where the parameters of the function reside. And this usually addresses the first parameter of a particular function. So, the first parameter of a function being associated with this, does that make sense? Well, from a certain perspective, this actually really makes sense, since for method calls, the only thing that that differentiates a method from a function is that it is called in relation to a particular object. So the function somehow needs to access the identity of the actual object. And the only way that we can do so far is, well, anything that we want to communicate to the function that we are calling, we usually do by putting that onto the stack before we call in the form of the usual parameters. So the usual way to realize things like methods is that we take the parameters that there are, shift them a little bit to the right, and then insert the thing that has been found as the object to which this method refers, and insert that as the new first
parameter of the method. So there's some kind of implicit transformation going on, moving the expression in front of the method call inside the slot for the first parameter, and everything else moves a little bit to the side. So this corresponds to what this load R-3 actually really does. So this accesses this first parameter, which is usually filled by whatever object this method is called on. So this is where the result of this expression goes to, usually. So this fits quite well. So in any case that we want to address the actual representation of the object that corresponds to this method, well, then we usually do load R of -3. And this is what is done here also. So for this, this is usually a reference to the actual object. So this is translated directly into this load R -3. And here for this attribute access, we first load the start of the representation for the object with a load R -3. Then we load an offset within this object representation with this load CA, add this together, and with that we obtain the absolute address of the attribute that we want to access here. So, to make things simple and nice to use, we then make some macros out of that. So we take the things that we find here and put them into macros for either loading or storing directly. So this is with this load MQ or stored MQ. And that's that. So what we've learned from that is that in object orientation, we can usually find the reference to a current object as the first parameter of the function. There's certain architectures or translation schemes that keep an explicit specific register for pointing to the current object, this current object pointer. This would have meant that whenever we do the inner calls to other methods from other objects, we have to save this COP register and restore after we return from that thing. Can be done, but it's a question of, well, a question of playing around with the parameters and what is more performant for you, whether you want to do indirect memory addressing or whether you want the effort of keeping a register up to date. That's a matter of how your application code looks like and what works better for you. So concepts for this are out there for both cases. So, yeah. We just don't introduce something like that, and in that sense can reuse as much of the schema as we want. So the question is now that we have talked about keeping up the addressing scheme for the attributes and methods, how do we actually really call member functions? So there's several versions of that. There's the static member functions. Those are, in that sense, not translated any different from the functions that we have had so far. So they are just ordinary functions and can be called like that. For the non-static member functions, there's two versions of calling them that we can find in programs. There's the direct form
over here with just the name and the parameter expressions, or relative to some expression that usually evaluates to an object value. So, well, this looks different at first. However, the first version is just a special instance of the second one, where the object relative to which the method is called is just equivalent to this. So it suffices to focus on this second version of calling functions. So, what we have also already realized is that the object on which a function is called is passed as an implicit first argument. So this makes everything compatible to the addressing scheme for the this parameter for the this keyword. Now it depends on the actual flag with which the identifier for the function is marked. So if f now is a non-virtual function, then well, we can just proceed with this pre-done transformation, like passing the object as implicit first argument. We can then just proceed with static dispatching as we have done all along with an ordinary function call. And only if f is actually a virtual function, we now have to do special purpose code generation to insert a call based on the entry of the virtual function table. So let's dive right in. The non-virtual function, this is the one which is pretty standard all along. This has the parameter code generation as we are used to that. So this directly is the sequence of all the code R's for the parameters, followed by a new thing, which is this object in relation to which the function had been called. So for this, we now introduce another code L, which performs the address of E1 as the implicit parameter for the function call. And then we do the usual thing, like mark, call, and slide. And in between, we put the reference to the function there. So that is that. This works as long as the function looked up in the environment for this particular class is evaluated to a non-virtual function with the name or address _f. Yeah, so much for that. Then the more interesting one is for sure the virtual function. So this starts similar to the one that we have seen before. So this is code R for all the parameters. Also, we have to take into account the address of the object on which we perform the actual call. But now, if our function in our current environment is considered to be a virtual function call with the offset B, then what we will do is, well, there's still the old mark that we know, but now what comes here is, well, of course there is still the call and the slide, but what is in between is now a little bit different. So here there's a mysterious instruction load S2, another load constant of the offset that we had in there,
add everything together and load from there, and only then we do a call. So you see a lot of loads being performed there, and a little bit of address pointer arithmetic being performed. So question would be, what is all that actually doing? So first of all, let's talk about what this load S really is. So this is a shortcut for, what it does is it retrieves the content of the stack found at the distance to the stack pointer given by the parameter here. So it looks up in the stack at distance j, whatever it finds there, and puts it on top of the stack. With that, we can now go back to this one and try to follow what is actually really done here. So load S2 will go over the gap of 2, which is left by mark. So this mark thing usually does reserve 2 cells on the stack and directly accesses what is there and loads that on the stack, which is the address of the object. So this is then loaded into the memory. So this is looking into the object representation and loads from there, and this gives you usually what? At the start of the object representation, we usually find the virtual function table reference. So after this load, we have the address of the virtual function table on top of the stack. Then we put B on there, which is the offset retrieved from the address environment. We add the offset to the virtual function table address, which gives us an index in the virtual function table. We load from there, so we load the pointer stored at the virtual function table, which gives us then usually the pointer to the function, which is then used for calling. So this is what this sequence really does. So you see, I don't know if you follow discussions around C and C++ programmers when they bash each other. Then what you usually get to hear from the C programmers is, with all your virtual function calls, destroying performance with a lot of indirection and memory references. And this is typical chain of memory loads that you get from a virtual function call that is usually the point of criticism for the C programmer. C programmer usually considers those sequences of loads to be quite slow. Well, assuming that your compiler doesn't optimize the code in any way, you will end up with these things. So, as this is kind of tedious to actually really read, so these were the steps of loading that we have discussed, followed by the original call. We, since they only change in one particular spot, which is the offset to look up in the virtual function table, what we then do is we add a macro for that, which is this vcallb thing that performs this sequence of instructions and serves for calling in the context of a method the virtual method found at B in the virtual function table that is currently linked to via the object representation. So let's have an example. This is the final instruction found in the example from the beginning.
So there's a call that goes from next or accesses the attribute next and performs the method call last on this next thing, and well, in the body of the virtual method last, then what you see is that first of all you you access the pointer to this, because that is always the implicit parameter to be used in method calls. So you have to is it actually? No. Well, it's load M is sorry. Still, what is the case is the first parameter should be the object on which the method is actually called. This is not this in that case, but of course this is next. So the question is, why is load M of 2 here? This load M was the instruction that loaded the address of the attribute with offset 2 in there. So this is what this load M does. Next has the offset of 2 in there. So this is what's done. The pointer to next is put on top of the stack. Then we do the usual mark and then do a vcall at offset 0, which happens to be the offset that is given to method last. You might remember the layout of the VFT, which was pretty simple. There was only one entry, so entry 0 is the first entry there, which is pointing to last. So vcall 0 is done, and then we clean up everything with just a slide of 0. So, how do translations of actual member functions look like? So, they look pretty similar to what we have had as syntax before. So, there's a return type. We have the parameters together with the type. There's a name, and there's the actual block that defines the function. So, for defining member functions, there's not too much to do in terms of concepts, apart from one extra implicit argument that is given to the whole thing in case it is a member function, which is the pointer to the current object, which is then accessed inside of F via this being pointer type to the surrounding class type, object type, which is the class then. And this is statically translated to relative address -3 in the object representation, and that is that. All object local data is addressed relative to whatever that is. So, the code for that is pretty straightforward. There's just a setting of the extreme pointer as usual. There's allocation of local variables as usual, return as usual, and the code, which is, well, pretty straightforward as you would have expected that to be. The only difference would have been that there is another implicit parameter, but the parameters are provided to the function by the caller anyway. So the callee doesn't really have any consequences stemming from that. It's still just allocating local variables and setting the extreme pointer. So yeah, so much about that. So, for our example, to translate this method last, we generate the start label for starting a call to this thing. We have the usual enter of the extreme pointer. We have zero local variables, fine, let's do with that, alloc zero, and in the end we do return, yeah, that should be, is that, yeah, should be that. So then what do we do as instructions inside? Well, there is this this branching instructions on the condition if next is equal to null. So next we have already seen is the at offset 2 in the object representation. Before was the virtual function table slot and the slot for the actual info thing. So this is slot 2. This is loaded, and null in that sense translates to zero as a constant here. We perform the quality test and then do the actual branching via jump 08. So this all contributes to that part. Then, if the whole thing is zero, we continue with the, is that right? Jump zero. I would have expected then to return info. Versus. It's long since we had the schema. EQ produces zero if the comparison was false. Okay. Yeah. See? yeah. Spin the time. Well, EQ produces zero if the comparison is false. Then everything makes sense. So if the condition was true, then we go on with return info, which is this thing over here, and well, that just accesses the attribute info at position 1 and stores that at the position where the first parameter goes, and also coincides with the location that we expect for the return value, and then just perform an ordinary return. Done with that. And then there is the else part starting here with continuation there. So what we need first is, I think this is the expression that we already had on the slides before. This was the load M for the next, the mark for starting the marking, then performing the V call and the slide 0 to clean up afterwards. So this is just the expression we have constructed a few slides ago for next next's last call. And then with whatever we get from there, we just store at the return slot in the stack frame and perform the actual return thing. So this is that. Okay. So as a last thing for today, maybe constructors. This is what should initialize an object. So we find several of these things in languages. Here we focus on the version from down there with an with a call to the constructor via keyword new within an expression. So what this should do is it should allocate space for the object and return a pointer to this thing on the stack. This is pretty similar to what we have had for the structs already. We need to pass this newly created reference as a first parameter to the constructor, and then just proceed as if the whole thing would have been an ordinary call of a function member, of a member function. So let's have a look at that. So we have this expression new C with parameters. So this means that we have to reserve space on the heap for that. We do that with this new thingy. And how much do we have to reserve? Well, this depends on the size of the attributes specified in C, incremented by the size of the pointer to the virtual function table. So this is why there's a plus one. Then we perform the actual expression evaluation of the parameters, then retrieve the address of the object then, and then perform a method call as we would have had before. So this is mark load C of C and call. So yeah, that is that. The way that you define your constructors, the way that you find that within the syntax is like this, pretty much like it is for ordinary method specification, just no return type, and the name is the same as the actual class for which you define the constructor. And you can treat this thing just as an ordinary member function, but what you have to pay in mind is that you have to initialize the virtual function table accordingly. So, yeah. Well, the slide break is a little bit weird here for this one. So let's assume that a class C has virtual functions F1 to FR defined for C with the offsets and initial addresses being BI and AI depending on what FI I'm using. And those are accumulating into table VC, which is well known during compile time, being specific for a particular class C. And so what we introduce now is this new instruction virtual C that is there for setting up the virtual function table pointer in an object representation. So the object representation so far looks like this and is found there in the this slot of the frame. And what that does is it points the first element that is found in the object representation to the VC address. So, yeah, this boils down to this expression. So, yeah,
That is that. So for the example that we had, this means that we will come up with entering with 3 and 0 local variables. We put the reference to the virtual function table of C in there, and then there's a lot of code that is pretty hard to remember. I don't know why I always have to do that. Okay. So this is the actual code in the constructor. So what it does is it initializes the info field with a parameter and performs something on a global variable and puts the next field to 0. So going back, this was what has been done before. So we load the next parameter with this load load R minus 4. This is the next thing after this. And we store that in the attribute and pop everything away since the statement ends here. Then we do the increment of the global variable. So this is performed by this thing here. We load the current value of the local variable. We load the offset. We add. We store at the global variable and pop away with the expression thing. And then in the end, we create 0, store it for the next attribute, pop, because that is an expression statement, and then we can safely return for this constructor thing. And I think with that, we have reached the end of today's lecture. So let's continue next time. See you next week, and thank you for your attention.